Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sebastian Fawkes, whose latest novel is Engleby. Earlier novels include Birdsong, Charlotte Gray, On Green Dolphin Street, Human Traces. Most of your novels concern World War I, World War II. They take place in France, different places, and they're very, very meticulously researched in terms of history. This book is contemporary, takes place over the last 30 years or so, and it's an interesting departure.
Yes, normally when I'm planning a novel like Birdsong, for instance, I like to think, what is this book about? What are the ideas? What are the themes? What am I trying to make people think about? And of course, then, as you say, there's the setting, in that instance, the First World War, all this takes research and so on. And I really don't want to start a book unless I know where it's going, because I need to know what it's about. So it's like building a bridge across a big river. You have to have the spans roughly in place and the piers driven into the riverbed before you begin. The dread as an author is that you're going to spend a year on something and then realize that actually, you know, it didn't add up. When I finished writing my last novel, Human Traces, which had taken me about 5 years to write, which had been a great big planned military campaign, I had nothing really left in my head. And then one morning, as I was waking up, that sort of stage between sleeping and waking, this voice just came into my head, and it said, "My name is Mike Engleby, and I'm in my second year at an ancient university." Page after page of this stuff dictated itself to me. What I wanted to do was scribble it all down, but I knew that if I was sufficiently awake to be able to get a pen and paper, I'd lose his voice. So I just lay there and let it come to me, and then when eventually I got up and went to work, I wrote down as much of it as I could. And then I found that day after day following that, I was able to tune back into this guy's voice, and he was really, I mean, Mike Engleby wrote the book called Engleby. I just about took dictation from him, really. You know, this was a little unsettling.
Kind of channeling a guy who's a wee bit off, shall we say, makes it
hard. He is a wee bit off, yeah. But that was, of course, what intrigued me about the voice, was that it was, my brother read it early on, and he said, it's like listening to a radio that's just slightly off station. You can make it out, but there's something not right. There was definitely something not right with Mike Engleby's take on the world. He's clearly a clever guy, and he's clearly funny. The book made me laugh a lot as I wrote it, but it's a very dry, black kind of humor. What it is that's wrong with him, why his take on the world is skewed, we don't know, and I didn't know when I started writing. It was only about halfway through the book that I became aware just where we were headed. Mike's what you call an unreliable narrator, and this is, you know, we are all fairly familiar with this device. The person who's telling the story may or may not be concealing something from you. I think the point about Mike is that he knows he's unreliable, and he tells us that he's unreliable, and he's desperate, actually, to remember key things in his life, key incidents, but they've been blotted out either by trauma or by the vast amount of alcohol and pills that he takes. His sense of the past and of himself is very patchy.
But he's also incredibly honest. He tells the truth, and even if the truth hurts him, and he does that continually, particularly when he's talking about his early days, and he makes mention of the fact that he becomes a bully, or is drug-taking, or the fact that he can't remember and it bothers him.
Mike is a character who's not, if you met him in real life, I think you'd find him awkward, difficult to be with. He has one friend in the book called James Stellings, who's a very nice guy who just befriends him on their first day at college. And Stellings sums him up later on. He says, Mike was a very interesting guy, but he just wasn't much fun to be with. Whereas a lot of your friends, most people's friends, are fun to be with, they're nice people to be with, but they don't often say anything, to be honest, that is very interesting. Mike's completely the opposite. As you say, he is very honest. He says things that some of us probably think but don't like to admit.
One thing that's fascinating about him, as I was reading the book, is that as it went on, I cared less and less about his story. I just wanted to hear him.
I'm very, very pleased to hear you say that. That is exactly what I hoped you would feel. It's like it doesn't really matter what this voice tells you, as long as it goes on talking. You want to be in his company because his take on the world is so bracingly unusual. But in his oddness, there is truth. I mean, I share quite a lot of his opinions, despite my better instincts.
It felt as if this could easily be you speaking about your life and your history, setting aside certain Engleby characteristics and plot points, but not quite. His political take, I would gather, is probably pretty close to yours.
Yes, he finds himself kind of out of step politically at any prevailing time. But, in fact, I think most of what he says politically is pretty sound, oddly enough. But he's in disagreement with all the prevailing currents of opinion. You know, for instance, in the mid-80s in Britain, he becomes a reporter and he is sent to cover a general election. And Mike's simple view of politics is that you need some kind of market economy to generate some money and you need some social welfare to help people out. But this was considered a ridiculous position in Britain at that time. You had to be either a Labour Party person who really wanted central control, nationalised assets, sort of like a command economy, or you were a Mrs. Thatcherite, which was a complete free market and, you know, self-help was the thing, and sort of competition had a kind of almost moral force. And Mike says, well, this is just ridiculous. But of course now, 25 years later, we are all social democrats. I mean, the choice between the parties, we have three social democratic parties in Britain now. We had none then, well, just a fledgling one. So it's quite fun to get some stuff off your chest like that. But when you're writing in the first person, and I've never written in the first person before, you have to be very careful to keep a complete distinction between you and the character. And if you are unloading a little bit here and there, it's making me chuckle when I unload a bit like that. And on the Iraq War, for instance, Mike is absolutely scolding about that.
His comment on that, which is that we don't invade people, he's right.
That was the sort of morality of Britain in the 20th century, and this was how we knew we were the good guys, really. And it was also, you know, very frequently an American position, too. Boy, how we begged the Americans to join us in World War II. And it was, no, we haven't been invaded. It's a European thing. You know, we sympathize with you, but it's nothing to do with us. Then, of course, when Japan attacked, fine. But Mike is a guy that he kind of gets inside your head, and he got inside me. And sometimes when he does things similar to things which happened to me as a reporter, which I worked as a reporter for a while, he meets real people. You have to be a little careful about, because there are laws of defamation. Also, I don't want to be unkind or untruthful about living people. And there's a scene in which he meets the writer, Jeffrey Archer, decides almost immediately that this guy is off his trolley and is a completely fraudulent and just unbelievable person. And this was kind of pretty much following my own response to Archer when I met him.
Yeah.
But when I got to the end of that piece, I thought, well, fine, but what is the point in saying that this guy's a loser and a liar and so on? Everybody knows that now. That's no longer interesting. And furthermore, much more important, it isn't how Mike would see him. Mike has a perverse and different view. So I rewrote that whole section. It's not a very long, but it's only a couple of pages. And Mike ends up by liking the guy, and they become pals, and he invites Jeffrey Archer to his housewarming party. And Jeffrey comes round, and he makes a speech, and he brings champagne. You know, that was just so much more a satisfactory outcome for me.
There are two other people who pop up in the book. Ken Livingstone, who I believe is now mayor of London.
He is, yeah.
Is the interview that Engleby has with Livingstone similar to the one you did?
Yes. I mean, Livingstone is a person who, unlike poor old Jeffrey Archer, who's been in prison, Livingstone has a reputation and he could sue for defamation. Furthermore, I didn't want to sort of, be untruthful. I mean, he's a real guy. So the content of the exchanges between him and Mike, what's actually said, is pretty much what Livingstone said to me when I interviewed him many years ago. But again, it's a question of Mike's response to him. That's where the difference is. And Mike responds to him in a different way. But the purpose of having Mike Engleby meet all these people is that the reader has a vague idea of how these people are. And so it's by Mike's responses to these people that you see what Mike is like, and you see at what point his take on the world is very, very accurate and harshly cynical, and at what point it's actually off-beam and a bit frightening and a bit peculiar.
One final person, Margaret Thatcher. Mm. There's a section with Margaret Thatcher where he speaks with her. And again, is that from an interview that you did with her?
No. As a reporter, I spent sort of a day during an election with the press people following her around. I never had a one-to-one interview with her. So that's pretty much invented, but it's the kind of thing she says, very much the kind of thing she would say, sort of slightly home truths, occasional resort to you know, family values, simple housekeeping, and the words of St. Francis of Assisi. But the key there is she says to Mike, don't look back, don't look back, have no regrets. And the whole point about Mike's life is that it's full of looking back, and it's full of regret, and he's looking back at something he can't quite remember. Something bad has happened, he thinks. And so it's a sort of sad irony that Mrs. Thatcher's kind of home truths, which she's trotting out, have a big tragic resonance as far as he's concerned.
Well, Sebastian Fox, let's look at this book for a second and compare it to your own life. Okay, you grew up in a middle-class environment. Your father's a lawyer?
He was a lawyer, yeah.
And your mother came from a family. Her mother was an actress? Is that correct?
She was, yeah.
And your mother had a nervous breakdown when you were about 10. Did any of that play into this book?
Yeah, the thing about my mother has been, unfortunately, rather garbled and exaggerated. My mother enjoyed good health all her life. She never missed a day, so to say she had a nervous breakdown is a big exaggeration. But she was quite an emotional woman who had an interest in the way that the mind worked and so on. But I'd like to set the record straight as far as that's concerned. You know, if I think... She wouldn't thank me, God rest her, if she thought I was going around.
I think that was in Wikipedia. So.
Yeah, dear. Sure, the sort of background details of some of Mike's life are, very similar to my own. He's the same age as me. But, you know, as I was saying before, the important thing is when you're writing in the first person is to make a clear distinction between the experience of the character and, yourself. And otherwise, it becomes confusing. And the great thing about that, Mike's voice and his character it never really threatened to become me. It was always quite distinct. It was like having a kind of pipe lowered down into some deep region of my brain, but the pipe was completely watertight. There was no leakage of me into it, and thank God also no leakage of Mike out into me. We remained separate people.
The material at his prep school, Chatfield, what a horrible, horrible place. Did you experience anything like that?
This is the school he goes to when he's about 13. He wins a scholarship because he's a clever boy and gets to go to a private school of a particularly brutal kind. I went to a private school of a fairly rough and ready kind, but I'm happy to say that the experiences which Mike has did not happen to me. Everything that happens to him there, all the bad things, are sort of an amalgamation of things that I either knew about or saw or was told about.
Cambridge, his life in Cambridge is a lot mellower, and you can remember your own days in Cambridge. The difficulty in dealing with events in the 70s and early 80s is we all remember, those of us who are old enough, exactly when things happened, when albums came out, when music was available, and Engleby is very much into music.
Yeah.
Did you work on getting that straight, or did you just come out with your memory and keep your fingers crossed, or how did that work?
My previous books have all been, as we said earlier on, very heavily researched, but because this one was set roughly in my time, when it began, I didn't know exactly how old Mike Engleby was. But as we proceeded, I thought, well, he's obviously roughly my age. And then I thought, well, for ease of reference, let's make him exactly my age. I also, if you spent 5 years researching a book about Victorian psychiatry, you're kind of fed up with libraries and research. So one of the key elements, one of the key rules I gave myself while writing Engleby was no research, or at least nothing that can't be done just on the internet in mid-sentence and pick up at the last comma. Sure, I had to check certain dates of certain records, certain concerts, certain films when they came out, or I wanted him to go and see a film, and I'd worked out it was by now spring 1982, so I quickly go onto a site, find out what new movies there were then. I really did very little research. That was part of the joy of this book for me, because it's just so different from everything else I've done. But, having said which, I checked all the facts. So if I say and he went to see, Steely Dan playing on July the 4th, 1979, then you can be sure they were on then.
There are two interviews in there that are very strange. One is an interview to become a diplomat, and I understand your father wanted you to become a diplomat. The other is an interview for an up-and-coming newspaper that he turns down, but he has a great deal of contempt for the people speaking with him. Did either of those events happen in your life?
The diplomatic interview, he thinks he's going to become a diplomat. In fact, they're sounding him out to see if he wants to become a member of MI6, which is, as you no doubt know, our intelligence service. he's a crazy person to try and enlist because he's far too unstable, he's far too odd and peculiar and far too dependent on various substances to keep his equilibrium. And gradually they begin to realize this, particularly when he becomes implicated in or is questioned about the disappearance of a fellow student, so that offer is withdrawn. It wasn't an offer that was made to me, and I was never interviewed either to be a spy or to be a diplomat. I never chose that path. The interview with the startup newspaper, which is at that stage when he goes to be interviewed by it called The Nation and becomes The Independent, that is something that I did do. The course of my interview was very different from his, and I was more impressed by the people starting up the newspaper, and I went to work for them and helped them start The Independent, and indeed its sister paper, The Independent, on Sunday 3 years later. So again, you know, my take and Mike's are different.
A section of the book takes place in a mental hospital. Was there research there?
There is a high-security psychiatric hospital in England called Broadmoor, in which some of our most famous or infamous and disturbed criminals live. But it is a hospital, not a prison. It's an important distinction. And people like Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, so-called, and other people are there. And I did go and visit there. I spent a day there, and I did a reading class, actually, with some of the patients, which was a kind of scary but kind of interesting thing, because it was very difficult to know really where to pitch my little exercise. We read a poem together, and then we talked about it and what it meant, and we talked about the whole idea of creative writing. My normal take on creative writing, if ever anyone asks me, and I've occasionally taught classes, just for a week, literally, is the best way to be a creative writer is to write about things that you don't know. Don't write about your own life. Write about people, someone of the opposite sex, someone older than you or younger than you, someone who lives in a different country from yourself. Stretch your mind. Use your imagination. Get outside of yourself. But when I was talking to these patients in Broadmoor Hospital, it occurred to me that in their case, perhaps, this wasn't the best thing to do. And maybe some of them, since they all, by definition of being there, had exceptionally unusual stories to tell, might be better off by starting at home and moving on from there.
You're listening to an interview with Sebastian Faulks, whose latest novel is Engleby. One final question about Engleby, and then I want to talk about some other issues. This character, Stelling, who's his only friend, makes some predictions, and all of these predictions come out true, predictions of what would happen 20 to 30 years down the road. When you were writing that, how conscious was that? Was that a little Sebastian Faulks conscious joke, or was it just something that seemed to be welling up and you followed it, or did somebody actually make those predictions to you?
No, I think that in the late 20th century, I became aware in the sort of 90s of how much the world I was born into had changed, and things which seemed would never end ended all very rapidly, and I'm thinking particularly of the Cold War. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and we kind of expected a huge atomic detonation any day. And I know in this country, you know, kids at school had sort of drills every day hiding beneath desks and so on. But certainly the Iron Curtain and, you know, most countries of Europe living in this unfree, tyrannized world, you know, you just began to think by the time I was 25, this is the way the world is forever and ever. South Africa to the apartheid regime, you know, this had been in place for decades. None of these things would ever end. And then suddenly, in a space of a few years, the whole world changed, and actually changed for the better in, you know, almost every way. And it was a very invigorating time, I think, to be alive. The thing about political change and world change is that we're so quick to sort of discount it. It happens, oh, yeah, the Berlin Wall's down, fine, cool, okay, you know, there's going to be a bit of problems with the East German economy, but that's okay. I think it was a great period to live through, and when Stelling's kind of predicts to Engleby that these things are going to happen, he sees sense change in the world. Mike says, yeah, forget it, these things, they're immutable, they're not going to happen, you know, it doesn't happen, but they did.
Let's talk a little about your career and your life, Sebastian Faulks. At the age of 15, you decided to become a novelist, is that?
Yeah, it sounds rather horribly precocious, doesn't it? Like the kid who decides he's going to be a chemistry professor. But in my English class at school, we read Dickens and D.H. Lawrence and Jane Austen and so on, and I was just so extraordinarily thrilled by these books. And I think what thrilled me about them was that they showed that people's inner life was much more important than their outer life. I felt, as a young adolescent kid, I thought maybe I was the only person who had an inner life. And I was just so thrilled and amazed and uplifted to read in David Copperfield or Sons and Lovers or even Pride and Prejudice, all these men, young men and women, who were against society, felt excluded from it, felt pushed around by it, and yet had strong feelings and desires and wishes inside. And I thought, boy, this is the only life worth living. And I felt very against authority as an adolescent and against school and against all the weight of the older generation. And yet it appeared that by being a novelist, you could not only write about the underdog, you could write books which were essentially anti-establishment, that you were allowed to do that. And if you did it well, you got knighted by the Queen. So this seemed to me, you know, the best of all worlds.
Well, you wrote two novels that didn't get published, right?
I did. At least two, yeah. And, you know, it wasn't easy for me to find out how to be a novelist, first off. You know, I wasn't one of these kids who wrote lots of short stories and gradually built up like that. I was never really interested in short stories. I wanted to write the big novel right from the off. And, you know, you don't really know how to do that when you're 21. So the only way to learn is, well, two ways. One is read lots and lots and lots of books and try and figure out how it's done. And the other thing is to just do it and learn from your mistakes.
And the third novel, that was the one where you said, if I don't do this, forget it, I give up, and it sold.
The Trick of the Light. It wasn't really the book I wanted to write, but I just thought to myself, I've got to get something into print, otherwise I'm not going to pursue this. I, by that time, had a reasonably okay life as a journalist. I was employable, I had a job, I quite liked being a journalist. But it wasn't really what I wanted to be. But luckily, this book, A Trick of the Light, which is not at all a good novel, but it's kind of slipped into print. I was paid £1,500 for it. But it was published by a reputable publisher called Bodley Head in London and sank pretty much without trace. But it gave me huge encouragement. And the publisher did what publishers are meant to do, or probably or possibly some of them still do, which is to encourage. They knew they wouldn't make any money out of it, but they took a punt on it. They took a bet. And sure enough, the next book I wrote, The Girl at the Lion d'Or, was a much, much better book and did very well.
That's something that doesn't happen anymore, it seems, at least in America. This encouragement, this we're going to guide an author through a couple of mediocre books so that this author, one or two, so that this author can get their feet wet and not be discouraged, never happens. Now it's all or nothing. It's very strange.
All or nothing from the off, is that right? Well, I suppose it's all economic thing, but in fact, you know, if you're paying, I suppose my first novel, as I say, they paid me £1,500. They printed, I would imagine, less than 1,000 copies. So the whole thing, you know, and they sold some of them, so they had some income. But I doubt whether the whole thing, you know, cost them more than £3,000. And as an investment, you know, that's not huge, especially if you are generating income from your other authors. They were publishing Graham Greene at the time and various other people. So it seems to me to make sound economic sense. And, you know, you don't really have to pay a young first-time author a great deal of money in advance against royalties. You know, even today, I mean, I think a lot of ambitious young writers would accept, you know, $5,000 to get into print. I mean, some of them would probably pay $5,000.
A number of your books are about the First World War, and your grandfather was in the First World War. What drew you to that? Was it just the history, the family history?
No, it wasn't the family history. My father's father was too old to fight in the First World War, believe it or not. My mother's father did fight, though I didn't really know quite what he'd done. What interested me about the First World War was what it seemed to suggest to me about human beings and their capacities to carry on doing things which they shouldn't really be doing. All the accounts I'd ever read of this conflict, as men walked slowly into certain death, I just always wondered, why did they not stop? And also, why did the people killing them not stop? And the Birdsong, the central battle scene, is the Battle of the Somme, 1st of July 1916, when British forces suffered 60,000 casualties in one day. And I believe that some of the German machine gunners did sicken of the slaughter, and they were sitting in very well in place positions. They simply tapped the end of the machine gun with the heel of their hand, and it would go from one side to another and then automatically come back. And, you know, you could kill 20, 30, 40 men in a single spray as it swept across one field of fire and back the other way. And I think some of them felt sick to their stomach. And yet on and on and on and on it went, millions and millions and millions of men killed for very important reason that one can see, other than the kind of stubbornness of the powers involved. To me, the interest was the human aspect, and if you were that gunner or that man walking slowly towards his death, in the case of the British officers armed only with a pistol and with special red-coloured flashes on your uniform to make you an easier target. But they weren't really to make you an easier target, they make you visible to your men, but of course it had the effect of making them easier targets. I just wanted to know what this told us about humanity.
You came back to that era again in Human Traces, but I think looking at it a little bit in a broader view. When you're doing the research for both Birdsong, but more importantly for Human Traces, because it did occupy so much of your life, in terms of looking at the tail end of the 19th and the early 20th century and comparing it to 100 years later, do you see differences that surprise you, or do you see the similarities that are equally surprising or maybe shocking?
Human Traces is really about psychiatry and doctors trying to make early attempts at classifying mentally ill people in the late 19th century. I regard these men as great pioneers and great men. The confusion that met them when they first tried to get to grips with mental illness was so appalling that there was no chance that they were ever going to find cures for complicated disease, but merely to describe the symptoms and to try and separate them off into different illnesses which they could then examine was a great, great task. And really, we have made very little progress from 1910, which is when the sort of psychiatric part of the book ends, and 100 years later now. The progress that's been made in that area have been really fortuitous, which was stumbling over some drug treatment in the 60s, which by chance is able to control some of the worst symptoms of psychosis. And, you know, we have a generally more enlightened attitude towards mental illness. As far as what the rest of Human Traces and Birdsong deals with, which is the wider range of what human beings are, how we got to be how we are, I don't really see any significant change. Again, you know, there are very interesting advances in neurology and consciousness studies which, you know, try to explain how and in what way Homo sapiens is different from other creatures. Human Traces is a book about how reason and endeavor of very enlightened men and women took us a certain way towards understanding human nature or what we are. And Engleby is a very black and cynical and funny book which says that there is no such thing as the human self anyway, and certainly no such thing as a consistent character. Mike's view of life could be summed up by, in a way, that line in the famous book by Camus, The Outsider, when he's going to kill a man on the beach, and he says, I could have killed him or I could not have killed him, and in the end it would have come to exactly the same thing. So Engleby takes that view of life, that our sense that we are all individual people with destinies of our own of which we should be proud, and that we are all entitled to fulfillment on this earth and the maximum fulfillment of our own potential is a delusion, because we are really just, there's no such thing as mind, there is only brain, we are just particles. What we take away from Mike is a very strong sense of a human personality and of someone completely individual. So there is a conflict there.
If there's been any complaint about your work, Sebastian Faulx, it's too sentimental. And I'm just wondering if a book like Engleby is unconscious or conscious, whatever, a thumbing of the nose at those particular critics saying, hey, you know, that's not what I'm doing.
Certainly Engleby is about as unsentimental
that's what I mean,
a
yeah.
book as you could find. Sentimentality is a term that whose definition is a little unclear. I don't agree that my books have sentimental elements at all. I think that Birdsong and Charlotte Gray are absolutely unflinchingly unsentimental, looking at matters of death and life. The only area in which I consciously allow a degree of sentimentality is in the relationship between parents and children, and particularly mothers and children, and more specifically mothers and boys. And this is because this is the way that it is in real life. There is a degree of sentimentality in that relationship. Of course, I think the parent-child relationship is the biggest, most powerful, most important one in the world. But there is no doubt that in its expression there are degrees, elements of sentimentality. I keep the sentimentality much unrealistically small in my books, but I allow a tiny representative sample of it to come in.
Sebastian Faulx, Charlotte Gray became a film. Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with it, and what did you think of it?
Oh, I didn't have anything to do with it. No, they wrote a story which was a different story, really, from the one in the book. She ends up with a different man, and the book is about a woman's relationship with her father and her past, and the father doesn't appear, her past doesn't appear. So it was kind of disappointing, and the film was not well received. both because it had nothing to do with the book and people felt that it was made in the wrong way. It was made in a kind of David Lean epic way. And in fact, of course, the truth is in the book, the story that I wrote, there's no action at all. There's one shot fired in the whole book, fired by an architect with a shotgun. So, you know, that was all disappointing. But on the other hand, the two central performances, I thought, Cate Blanchett and Billy Crudup, were both extremely good. And it's a pity that films of books seldom work. They seldom work.
You also did a nonfiction book called The Fatal Englishman, multiple biography of an artist, an airman, and a spy. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
That came about after I'd written Birdsong, and I needed a book to write, but I had no sort of fictional ideas. I'd read a rather good book by an American called Calvin Trillin. It was called Remembering Denny, and it was about a classmate of his who seemed to be the most golden boy of his generation, and then blew up, never came to anything. And the problem was that there was a terrible sort of so-what over that story because he never did anything. But I thought if I could find an equivalent character who had that poignancy of early promise and early death, but I had actually done something, so there was more, he was more worth celebrating, that would be something. And then I thought, well, if this person only died age 30, then that's only a third of a life, so maybe I should do three of these people. So I got the kind of formula or the shape of the book first, and then I found three interesting people, I think, to write about. And as I was researching their lives, I found that they overlapped and interlocked in quite strange ways, which made me feel that it was sort of good karma. I was onto something there.
Do you think that the work you did on there influenced your novels later on?
I hoped that it would generate ideas for novels. And, for instance, that one of the three subjects of The Fatal Englishman, Richard Hillary, was a pilot. And looking at his life as a pilot helped me to develop one of the main characters in Charlotte Gray, Peter Gregory, who's her lover, who's a pilot. And the work I did on the third person, who's called Jeremy Wolfenden, who was a journalist who also was an unwilling spy in Moscow in the early 60s, that helped me with some of the background for On Green Dolphin Street, a novel I subsequently wrote. So, yeah, writing that book was helpful to me.
You also became the newest author of a James Bond book, and you've apparently already written the book, correct?
Yeah.
Literary author suddenly goes off and writes someone else's character. How did that come about? How comfortable did you feel doing it?
It came about last summer when Ian Fleming's family asked if I'd go and see them. This is his sort of descendants, who were very keen to keep his name and the books going. And they put this proposition to me that the next year, 2008, is the centenary of Fleming's birth, and they want to have a lot of celebrations, and, you know, there's exhibitions and all sorts of things. But the centerpiece of that, they wanted to be a new novel. And they wanted it to be written not by a thriller writer, but by someone who would completely surprise the public. And I said, do you realize my last novel was a 600-page literary effort on Victorian psychiatry with not a gun or an Aston Martin in sight? And they said, that's exactly why we want you, someone coming from a different angle. I said, well, I haven't read these books since I was 12 or 13 years old. And I was very doubtful about the whole thing, but I looked at the books again, and I was quite impressed by them. They have their silly moments, but they were surprisingly well written, and you have this genuine sense of one lone guy in danger. And they were kind of exciting. But what turned it for me was reading an article that Ian Fleming had written, which was called How to Write a Thriller, in which he described his working day. And it says it should take you 6 weeks. You write 1,000 words in the morning. Then he would go snorkeling from his house in Jamaica, have a large martini at lunch, a siesta, write another 1,000 words, a bit more swimming, a few more cocktails, dinners with beautiful women, and so on. If you do 2,000 words a day, it takes you 6 weeks. I thought, well, I could do that. I mean, I had to cut down on the snorkeling a little in my London house. But apart from that, it was done and dusted in 6 weeks. A lot of serious authors between books, they find that period difficult. Some people write for the movies. I mean, you know, Gore Vidal wrote Caligula, for heaven's sake. Some people will write a children's book. Some people, you know, do, I don't know what they do. But it's always difficult. And finally, I found a way of filling it. It was good fun. It was enormously good fun. Not a serious project, but on the other hand, you know, I did it as well as I could.
How many of the books did you go back and read them all?
I read all the Ian Fleming ones, yeah.
And none of the later ones?
No, I didn't want to confuse myself, because, yeah.
Was it easy to find the voice?
Yes, it was. I mean, I do a radio show back in London, it's a quiz, and a book quiz, and at the end of it, you have an author of the week, and you have to do a parody of that author's work, and it's a sort of against-the-grain kind of parody. And one of the authors, funnily enough, we'd done was Ian Fleming. The exercise we were given was James Bond goes shopping. So I had Bond lowering himself in through the ceiling above the cereals aisle and so on. But, you know, if you study someone's style, I mean, I just analyzed how he wrote, and it wasn't very hard to get that rhythm. What I was keen to do in my Bond book was not to write a parody or a pastiche. So the style I came up with is like 80% Ian Fleming. I thought if I went further towards it, you know, it was a danger that it was going to look like I was, you know, pulling the leg and, you know, taking the mickey. So I pulled back at that point. I think it's worked okay.
And his last published story was Octopussy. So this happens right after that.
That's right. The chronology is not completely precise, but there are references at the beginning of my story to Bond having had a bad time and having had a bit of a sabbatical, but he's now ready to resume his duties. So anyway, what I tried to do was look at all the Fleming books and leave out the stuff that wasn't any good and take all the good bits and all the good characters and make something that was, in fact, the best thing that happened was Barbara Broccoli, who's the daughter of the film producer who did all the early ones, was sent a copy of this, and she said, if you'd told me you'd found this book in Ian Fleming's desk drawer after his death, I would have believed you. And it's like the sort of the missing one. So that was a very gratifying response.
Have they made any overtures about turning that one into a later Bond film?
They're looking at it, but they won't make up their mind for another year until they see them in the process of making the second film with Daniel Craig at the moment. So they'll see how that goes and then what story they want to do.
Of course, the other thing is you said it in the 60s, and the Bond films of today are contemporary.
That's true, but it's kind of portable. I'm not allowed to tell you what it's about, otherwise I'd have to kill you. But the central activity of the villain still has very, very considerable contemporary relevance, and the settings are also daily more relevant, so it would be very transferable.
Sebastian Faulx, you finished Anglebee, and you finished the James Bond book, which comes out next spring. You begun working on another novel, and is it a historical novel?
I haven't begun yet. And it will be contemporary. It'll be set in the 21st century, though I think. I have so many ideas at the moment that I'm not sure that whether they all belong in the same novel. I think maybe I have three or four coming up. But one of the things about Anglebee and why I'm so happy with the book is that it's given me a way into the present day. And I found it difficult to write about Britain and the world in the 21st century before, but I think I've now found a way in.
You've been listening to an interview with Sebastian Faulx, whose latest novel is Anglebee. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.